themselves psychically adept, but somehow she'd fallen into the chasm that divided the two camps. Maybe that was the lesson. Maybe the act of trying to sever a vein or climbing into the oven was like going to the caves, a beginning. Sophie opened her eyes. The walls were alive. So many possibilities, but not now. Relax, she instructed herself, resuming her former position. In time. And now she was not even wondering anymore about time or motion, was simply staring into space. A no longer middle-aged widow woman on a sumptuous chair on a purple rug on a parquet floor on a cement stage fixed in red clay on a bed of black dirt and then the wood and bones of an old buried-over cemetery. On sand, silt, ash, on rock, tar pits, the earth's crust, its pin. And at the very core of the earthworks, her stomach dropped down to, and at the center of, the universe her temples throbbed toward, and somewhere in between where her heart beat, the divinely healthy, whole Velma waited to be called out of its chamber, embraced and directed down the hall to claim her life from the split imposter. But called out from the mouth of the heart, coaxed out silently by baby-catching hands. For not even for her, not even for this, would Sophie break discipline, break her silence. She almost had, after a mere 16 hours of the new moon, once to cry out when Serge's assistant had called her on the phone, but the news of the spitting, biting, bleeding, thrashing Velma, actively hallucinating, the man said. It had so taken her breath away, she could get nothing in her throat to work. And once again, she'd almost spoken to settle Cora Ryder's hash, but her eyes had accomplished what her mouth would not. But the hardest test of all, wanting so to speak her speak to her godchild.
And did you think your life is yours alone to do with as you please? That I, your folks, your family, and all who care for you have no say-so in the matter.
Whop! Sophie leaned back in the chair, and the chiffon roses on her hat were finally still, were finally through with bobbing and fluttering. She sat still, though the chair dumped her, sat still, though her legs climbed through circles on the same longitude where mighty titans poised underground like dragon's teeth, snapping at the life of radishes, yams, grasses, and grains, altering the natural cycle, heating up the earth. Climbed on through several circles, through turbulent waters in search of a saline solution, through earthquake landscapes and landslides and grumblings where the grinding of the earth's plates gnashed, disturbed. She sat still while motion raced through the office, seeking its lack, searching her out, attempting to lure her from stillness, sucking at the petals on her head, slapping at her earrings, tugging at her belt buckle, beating against her wedding band to no purpose, like hammering cold iron. She was still. It could have been a 4x4 cell she sat in, a metal ledge of a cot, and not hot leather severing her legs from her thighs, a concrete floor with bloodstains her feet pressed against, a stinking toilet with no lid she stared into, her neighbor, Edgers, not fatigue, bending her head down. Forehead icy, downpour from her nose, Sophie was swimming in a broth. And once again, she almost broke the spell, a threat of an old gospel or line of scripture quivering under her tongue. Silence. Stillness. To give her soul a chance to attend its own affairs at its own level. She breathed quickly, lightly, dispelling pictures, thoughts, sounds, but Velma's Swahili wailing whistle filling up her head. Velma throwing her shadow across the screen door that day she came back to marry James Henry and not Smitty.
My dear?
Oh,
I'm back.
I can see that, V.
working hard to dump the bread-pudding face into the wastebasket and clear her head. Those lumpy freckles so like raisin moles on her Mama May's face and shoulders, but on May's daughter, like eruptions, the ooze of Velma's lava threatening any minute to engulf everything. How you and everybody doing?
Everybody doing?
Would be Smitty in the wheelchair, straining. Smitty between the parallel bars, groaning. Smitty on the gym mat, fighting his way back from the floor and the academy master pulling no punches. Smitty with a towel around his neck, smiling for life, winning for life. Velma's letters to Smitty abruptly stopping. Velma, home to marry James Henry. Velma flinging her life into an oven. How to explain that to Mama May when she returned from church retreat? Behind Velma, by the pole beans, was Edgers in his overalls, a light dusting of sawdust saying he'd been to the mill and her porch would be fixed. Edgers standing there with his sheriff-ruined hands hugging each other behind the bib of his overalls, the purple nails, the bunioned growths, the gnarled joints, hands that could manage an axe or a hoe, but nothing so dainty as a wooden match. And Sophie going to the screen door to let Velma in, one hand on the latch, the other in her apron pocket fingering the fragile blue matchbox Edgers had handed her one day, the day they could finally look at each other and finally speak without holding their breath. To light a pipe was easy enough. She'd been lighting Daddy Dolphy's for years, and the other men's who turned up in her yard to trim the bushes or turned up on her porch to bung the cider crocks or secure her mailbox. All the men of the district who had no wives finding their way to her house to pay off the debts they said they'd been owing her husband for years, they said. "Give me a light," they each said in so many ways, having none of their own. Edgers at least supplied his own fire, his own light, his own sweat, his own energy, and gave light, always found the space to let the sun in, never ever cornering her to say she was a settled woman and ought to quit her activities and settle on a man, a sewing machine, a stove, never once frowning on her work, her traveling, saying only, "I'll mind the place," or, "Do you want my truck?" Edgers was standing by the pole beans, scraping his work boots against the edge of her brick walk, and she held her breath as his words floated toward her. "Get used to me, please, Sophie," was all it was. Then, turning to attend to things, mending the fence, liming the trees, sharpening her axe for her, turning over the earth, dumping out sacks of bone meal, chicken droppings, a compost of his own making that would promote new growth, new life, and no sense telling him he needn't, 'cause he needed, and she knew it each time she combed her hair, and she needed. "Get used to me, please, Sophie," he had said after all this time. She thought she had. "Got his nerve," Velma had said, wiping her feet on the mat as if to kick up dust and jute in Edger's face. How could he look you in the eye after what he's done? "And what's he done, V?" Moving aside to let her in. "What's he done?" Velma, searching her face for signs of amnesia or senility. Velma clearly under the spell of the rumor version of her beating in the jail. "That bastard ought to cut off both his hands." Then, closing her eyes as if the mere thought of Sophie's terror was too much to bear, even in memory, even second hand, and Sophie wanting to grab her by the shoulders and shake her for Smitty, shake her for Edgers, herself, shake her till her head flopped. Edgers had had a pistol in his neck, but had refused to go on beating her and been beaten himself. Sophie exhaled it all out, and tried to go blank, tried to switch off memory's pictures and supplant them with peaceful scenes, to go gathering the feel of the basket handle on her arm, to talk with the lemongrass, enlist the cooperation of eucalyptus. They didn't mind her, did not resist her, always came up easily in her grip, eye bright in the underbrush calling, bladderwort singing, calamus around the salt marshes, one of the few places the spirits had not withdrawn from in disgust, neglected, betrayed. Cool breeze, walking barefoot, quiet lapping of thick waters against the embankment, the gathering of fresh things, natural things, fish herbs, salad greens, natural growth. No forced foods to weaken the will to live. No old, dead food for the folk of her boarding house. Food in tin cans on shelves for months and months, and aged meat developing in people's system an affinity for killed and old and dead things. Wasn't that what happened to Lot's wife? A loyalty to old things, a fear of the new, a fear to change, to look ahead? Sophie's favorite lesson at the academy, Lot's wife and the changing order. She'd been ossified. To go gathering, Sophie sighed, and let her soul get on with its gathering and return with greater force to its usual place. But so hard to do. What the hell, V, did you think you were doing? Cutting on yourself and trying to die in an oven? And with so few seasoned workers left. Whop! And how would Mama May find her daughter in the spring? Sophie eased back into the chair and let it lift and swirl her, imagining Serge spinning so, while the infirmary workers tended their duties and he in his wonderful chair contemplating new ways to implement the pleasure box principle. She smiled for him. How simple life was for people like Serge, who maintained that all knowledge, all energy, all problem-solving techniques resided in the groin, the loins, the pelvis. She smiled, but she longed for contact with her drifting soul, longed for illumination and realization for conscious contact. So many things she needed to learn yet. To understand, to share, but she would not break her discipline to comfort herself in a shallow way, would no more break discipline with herself than she would her covenant with God. Fred Holt took the shortcut through the infirmary yard. He nodded to the boys and young men roosting on the tabby wall, passing joints back and forth, passing pint bottles back and forth, or just sitting and talking. Some were waiting for the girls, scarce women, who waddled to and from the clinic each day between 3 and 4. The men reminded him of the wives who used to congregate outside of the palace or the regal, waiting on their musician husbands, waiting to take them home. Some of the other roosters were waiting, no doubt, for the swayback girls from Safe Harbor, the shelter the academy and the church ran for runaways. There was a big stink about that in the papers lately, since most of the kids had run not from their own homes, but from those other homes, and were under court order. Those academy folks were in for it unless the ministers could work something out with the authorities. Between the trees and the cars and the vans of the parking lot behind the Regal, he could make out the wall of respect of the academy. He almost stepped on it. A small bird calling to the air, a tiny bird that had fallen from its nest, evidently, had fallen into a plate some not-so-hungry picnicker had left behind. Fred glanced at the plates, pots and jugs, and wondered what kind of weird picnic it could have been. So much food left. He tilted his cap back and stared at the bird and wondered what he was supposed to do about it. It had been a day for birds, he chuckled to himself, glad to be out of the driver's seat and on foot. Leaning against the tree on the other side was a couple murmuring into each other's face, oblivious of the bird, the plates, and him, and not seeming to know about the caterpillars that were known to drop from this particular tree from late winter and straight through spring. They were leaning against each other, her hands under the front of his shirt, his hand cupping her neck. Fred took off his hat and rubbed his outstretched arm against his sweaty forehead. "Tie your apron high, Miss Lucy," he whistled to himself, moving on, wondering at what point a hairy green worm might break up the idol. Coming out of the rear parking lot, he got sandwiched in by two winos hunkered down in the old stage entrance doorway of the Regal and a boy with a bike. A mud puddle was in his path, the pigeons circling, fluttering, crowding each other for a drink. He didn't like what the sight of the nasty pigeons or the puddle was doing to his chilly, ruined stomach. The bums weren't any better, snot-nosed and filthy. He waited on the kid to move. He was taking his time, down on one knee, tying a sneaker that looked like a planter or a magazine rack or one of them satchels he'd seen in shop windows designed like a basketball sneaker. Fred was glad he didn't have to feed this kid. Fred was glad he didn't have a kid anymore. He didn't seem to have a son anymore either when it got right down to it.
"How you doing?"
"Hey." Fred waited, but that was all he was going to get. One of them self-contained types. His bike basket crammed with folded newspapers he'd be slinging around all over town. Fred could just see the kid at the doors collecting for the week. Nobody'd give this kid any song and dance about no change or come back next week or I paid you already. Not with them feet. A mere 12 or 13, he had feet that could put the garbage compactor companies out of business.
"Excuse me."
The kid had finally looked up and was rushing now, sort of, folding down his thick white socks he probably washed every night himself on one of those old-fashioned washboards, if they still sold them, folding the socks down neatly over the top of the incredible red and white shoes. A good kid, not the type to give his parents any grief unless they were the sort that had groomed him to be a brat or a mama's boy. Fred searched himself for something to say to him, something appreciative and friendly and encouraging, but the boy on his feet now, those incredible feet, was hiking up the kickstand and preparing to move out, pausing only to look at the winos and then at Fred. Fred straightened and tried to do in posture at least what the mud puddle and the pigeons wouldn't permit, to create distance between himself and those bums. The boy might be measuring his own possibilities, studying them as a preview of things to come. Fred wanted to stand for something opposite, for something hopeful and good. He stood there, trying to look like what he'd hoped he could be for his son. But the pigeons were splashing his pants, his shoes, and his concentration was broken each time he looked at those bindle stiffs and longed to block print the word neatly on newsprint with a freshly sharpened number 2 pencil.
"Take care, son. See ya."
And the moment had passed, and Fred felt corny. He looked at the drinkers and looked at the pigeons and philosophized.
"So used to dipping your beaks in muddy water and turpentine, wouldn't know what to do at a fresh lake spring if you got a paid vacation." "My people, my people," he sighed aloud,
eyeing the two gents who were eyeing him, hunkered down in the glass-splattered doorway, passing the bottle back and forth, picking around in a pile of butts they'd evidently gathered for just this moment. He tried his hand at caring. The uglier of the two was lighting a match and cupping it very, Fred decided to just go ahead and say, tenderly, just for the fun that was in it. The bum got the butt lit,
but had to suck like crazy to keep the stubby bent thing going, blocking the draft kicked up by the pigeons with his knees, like maybe his ancestors did at the mouth of the cave. The other was very ceremoniously skinning back the brown paper bag and rubbing the bottle with his dirty sleeve. They toasted each other, drank, toasted Fred, drank. In another few years, who knew, he was thinking, his mouth drooping, matching the drool of their lips. And then he was walking on their side of the puddle, making them draw in their feet, red wine oozing down their scraggly jaws and darkening greasy collars. They toasted each other again, grinning as if to seal a bargain. No headhunting in each other's caves. They toasted Fred's back as he muttered shit, their arms high, another victory over cannibalism, it would seem.
"Happy carnival,"
one of them drawled, and Fred lifted his arm in a half wave, half brush off.
"Bindle stiffs,"
he sneered, blocking the letters neatly. Folks on the hill were readying up for the festival or whatever it was. Kids racing by with streamers and balloons, masks and noisemakers in store windows, flower carts on the sidewalks, the incense peddlers in granny square caps of holiday colors. Years ago, when he'd first settled in Claiborne, things didn't officially start till the first Saturday after spring. In some parts of town, the Catholics kicked things off on the Tuesday before Lent. The Greeks had a parade on the first Saturday after Easter. But in the community, Hoodoo Man broke out of the projects with a horned helmet on some particular day near the first of spring and led the procession through the district to the Mother Earth floats by the old railroad yard. It always caught Fred off guard. He could never keep track of the day from one year to the next. The talk on the hill, he was overhearing, was that things would get started at midnight tonight in the park.
"Got your lists ready, partner?"
"You know it,"
Fred hollered toward the old man at the bus stop, who was loosening his false teeth and wrapping them in a not-so-clean hanky. What lists these might be was a mystery to Fred. He vaguely recalled, though, pausing in front of the Regal to read the concert posters, that there'd been a bonfire years ago and Margie had insisted on going. But it seemed to have been winter, New Year's Eve, as he recalled. People were supposed to write down all the things they wanted out of their lives, bad habits, bad debts, bad dreams, and throw them on the fire. Margie would never tell him what she'd written, but it couldn't have been much, just a strip from the flap of an envelope. Didn't take but a second to scribble whatever it was. Fred ran his hand over the posters. This was great, live music again at the Regal after all these years. The place probably smelled like mothballs, or mildew. Had been a church for a while. Then a place for rummage sales. For a while, a community radio station had been housed there. For a season, musicals from Broadway had played the Regal. But for a long time, it had been dark.
"I'm wishing for the moon,"
the toothless man crooned behind him, anxious for Fred to hurry up and turn away from the posters and join him. That would be the other list. One was supposed to draw up a list of dreams and pin it on the Mother Earth float or stick it in the Horn of Plenty or shove it up her skirts or something. He'd seen envelopes and dollar bills tacked to the side of the float, scraps of paper pinned to the billowing skirts of the woman who rode the rickety thing through the district to the old church. He never could see getting in a funk about it all. It was all foolishness. Instead of writing Santa Claus notes, people ought to get armed and get with it. He turned from the box office and gazed across the street, wondering if there was anything in the story of guns hidden there in the academy.
"Our finest monument,"
the man was saying, pointing a shaky finger toward the wall of respect.
You're right there.
He stared with the faith of X-ray eyes. He'd like a chance to prowl around invisible in there one time. Be invisible and free to search. That was what Porter had been beating his gums about those last days, being invisible. He'd thought at first Porter had lost his marbles, but seems he didn't mean invisible invisible like the old Claude Rains movie. Something stranger, it turned out. Porter had been out early walking around the Salina, as he called the marshes, and whom should he run into but the town character, the hermit, they called him, and for 3 solid days, when it wasn't Yucca Flats 55 and dying, it was the hermit's views on this and the hermit's views on that, and being invisible. For a hermit, the guy was sure gabby, the way Porter kept going on and on about all he'd said.
Invisible is being not visible, Fred, not looking like the something or someone a cop is after or a trickster is expecting.
Looking different from what's expected.
That and more, Fred. Like when you're looking for a 4-hole, thick blue button to sew on your jacket, the tape measure and needle pads and all that other stuff you just don't see. You barely notice the 2-hole brown buttons. What did Fred know about a sewing basket? But he'd sat there in the pit stop chewing on the spongy bread while Porter had gone on about being invisible. They call the black man the invisible man, and that becomes a double joke, and then a double cross, then a triple funny all around. Our natures are unknowable, unseeable to them. They haven't got the eyes for us. Course, when we look at us with their eyes, we disappear, you know?
He ordered another cup of tea and made the waitress pull out everything in the back, hunting for some honey she'd been silly enough to say she'd once seen back there when he asked. Since when did Porter drink tea and honey? Even had his own sack of loose tea. Fred had thought it was marijuana for a moment, and thought again, old Porter had really lost his marbles pulling it out that way.
So, it's not just looking different, Fred, but being different. Your true nature, invisible, because you're in some incongruous getup or in some incongruous place, or the lookers got incongruous eyes, you know? He's one shrewd cookie, the hermit. His name's Cleotis. Fine old dude. I'm going to study with him soon's I get on the night shift again.
And that had hurt Fred. Hearing Porter wanted to go on nights, they'd raised sand about being put on nights all the time, 'cause they were colored was the reason. And almost as hurting, not being able to crack on the hermit anymore. He'd changed status overnight from nut to wise man. But the hurtingest part was the voice. Something in Porter's voice, like Wanda's when she found the way, joined up with them Muslim people, talked off the wall in a voice that shut him out. All the time she was saying he should come with her to temple, should come hear this or that speaker, but something in her voice was locking him out.
How long you think it'll take?
Not sure what he was asking Porter, but trying to stay in.
Like he tells me, ain't no graduates from the university I study at.
How long?
Maybe he could wait it out. Maybe it was a sometime thing. He had hoped for that before and lost.
How long does it take to learn to be invisible?
Don't know.
And those were the last words he'd heard out of Porter. And he still didn't know whether it meant nobody knows, or the wise man wouldn't say, or he, Fred, could never know, or that Porter didn't need to know 'cause the question was totally beside the point.
ignorant.
You ever been over there?
Big place. Lots of doings at the academy. Fred shook his head no, then yeah, then bobbed his head any old way as the old-timer nattered on and on. Well, maybe he'd go see the hermit. Maybe the man had some answers. Fred was pretty sure he had some questions, but at the moment what he had were needs. To shower, shave, get into some fresh clothes, do the last run, get those doctors out of his hair, maybe go out on the town, catch the show at the Regal. He was smelling something bad and wasn't sure whether it was the old man or himself. He inhaled carefully. There was throbbing in his stomach, trembling in his throat, and he didn't have a fresh hanky. He nodded to the old man and headed back toward the infirmary. 7. Obi tried bouncing from the waist, then chinning on the bar in the doorway of the massage room. He felt a catch in his side. Tight muscles and joints, he instructed himself, contained suppressed feelings, memories, energies. He tried thinking that through, tried recalling recent entries in his journal. He was blank. He'd been using a confounding code, worried that Velma might snoop. That would never have occurred to him before.
The oboe.
The masseur was grabbing his face in his hands, and Obi embraced him, patting his back with both hands. It never failed to trip him out, this effusive Korean from Arkansas. He owned every album his homeboy, Pharaoh Saunders, ever cut.
When are you going to come to my class?
He was helping Obi onto the table, wasting no time, arranging the sheet.
I want to teach you about release points. You already know about pressure points, and that's tough enough for combat. But for health, stress points, release points. Your back's one big rock quarry, oboe.
Your hands are like hammers.
Hey, I'm a gentleman.
He had taken his hands away in mock offense, but wasting no gestures, rolled the kimono sleeves onto his shoulders.
Like the song says, massage is my meditation and my dance.
You just make that up. For an answer, Obi was flattened out on the table. He felt drowsy, chin greasy from Ahiro's hands, his head was slipping off the table. Eyes level finally with the band of pain between the window shade and the window ledge. Through the hedges, he could make out the Regal across the street. And past the parking lot, the tabby wall where the brothers sat shooting the breeze.
I'm not trying to slide your wedding band off, just trying to get out the knots. Relax, breathe.
But she couldn't relax, not Velma. Walking jags, talking jags, grabbing his arm suddenly and swirling her eyes around the room, or collapsing in the big chair, her head bent over. He'd grown afraid for her. She talked on the surface, holding him off, shutting herself off from herself, too, it seemed. And at night, holding her, he felt as though he were holding on to the earth in a quake, the ground opening up, the trees toppling, the mountains crumbling, burying him. Then he'd grown afraid of her.
Pressure points of the human body. Pressure points of the system. The U.S. pressure, yeah.
He heard himself drowsy, distracted. His conversations of late seemed no less than Velma's diversions.
Points of the body, apply pressure to the system, parallel. Interesting.
Your enthusiasm, Obo, whelms me over. Don't talk. Relax. Listen. You remember them Euro-Americans over at the Hurdy Farm, just 2 hours out of the city? That New Age community, they call it? Heavy.
They say Clybourne's a major energy center, one of the chakras of this country. How you like them apples? Talk about some parallels. They're trying to recruit third world people. Check them out sometime. But for now, relax. Just give me your leg, oboe. Your calf feels like a brick. She was like a brick, a stone, a boulder that would not be moved. He didn't know how to lift her. He didn't know how to satisfy her anymore. Give me your tongue. And she might flick it dry, totally preoccupied, over his bottom lip, and he would suck at the tip while the blood engorged his joint. He would rub against her, trying to get her attention, and she would mumble something, but only that he get up, turn the lights on, and take the robe flung over the closet door down and shake it out. Night after night being sent to the closet or the chair to assure her there was nothing there and no one there that should not be there, and coming back toward the bed, looking at her twisting in the covers or climbing on the pillows, he would stare at her opening, glistening and wet, inviting, misleading. He would gather her up again, but inside she was dry and her muscles clenched before he could enter deep, clench, and shut him out.
Let go, Velma,
groaning into her neck.
Don't let go, Obi,
trembling in his arms. The whole town's waiting to see the parade, oboe. The smart money says you militants are planning to shoot up the town.
Haven't heard that word in a while. Militant.
Was that a sidestep? A hero's hands waited for about 8 beats, then bore down on Obi's shoulders, flattening him out again. An old blue Packard in the back lot of the Regal had moved, and now he could see the double windows of Doc Surge's office. Maybe Doc could help. Velma had never much cared for the man, but he'd explore that. There was the woman with the gift on staff there, too. Maybe. And maybe he could spring Roland and bring him home.
I hope you don't have any more appointments today.
A hero was helping him turn over, patting his back as though apologizing for having not solved the rock quarry problem.
You need some steam, the whirlpool, and if you want, I can get you back on the table around 4:30. Your chest is like a granite slab.
His voice was sorrowful.
Oboe, you know what you really need?
Something in the way his voice dropped and trailed off made Obi hold his breath, then lift his head, one eye open. Was Ahiro about to offer him a joint, or was he about to hit on him? Obi squinted.
What?
A good cry, man.
Good for the eyes, the sinuses, the heart. The body needs to throw off its excess salt for balance. Too little salt and wounds can't heal. Remember Napoleon's army? Those frogs were dropping dead from scratches because their bodies were deprived of salt. But too much. Obi opened his eyes in time to see Ahiro's hands finishing the statement, one hand flowing along a current of air, stopped by the other, clenched, fisted, and gnarled. And then his hands were on him again, and Obi closed his eyes. Ahiro was making flat circles in Obi's stomach with the heels of his hands, pressing, then releasing. Obi felt his stomach flutter the way it had the day he'd followed Velma and lost her in the supermarket. He hadn't known what he'd expected. A rendezvous? A visit to a fortune teller? Streaking through the streets? She'd simply gone shopping for groceries. He'd been almost disappointed. He'd hoped the new prayer partner, Swami, Shrink, or whoever the blood called Jamal was, would turn out to be it. He would have liked something concrete to fix on.
You're not listening. A good cry, man.
Nobody here but you and me. Your masseur is like your doctor, priest. You know what I mean?
Hey. Obi gave him a brotherly punch on the arm. I hear you.
Well, okay then. Too much stiff upper lip is not good for the soul.
You British?
Nah, man. Too much face, it not so good either. Next thing you know, you're forced to fall on your sword. You from Japan?
I heard you, Ahiro.
Well then, are you from Macho, whatever country that is?
Do your meditation and your dance, Ahiro. I'm too tired to laugh.
Never be too tired to laugh, Obo. He was working on the balls of his feet, and Obi was sliding up the table, his head dropping off. Looking out the window from that angle, he could see the dome of the Regal Theater, tarnished and spattered, but shining. He could see the underside of the infirmary's sun deck, the weathered plants, a nest in the crook of one of the braces.
Or to groan to cry, Obo.
Obi lifted his head.
Hey, Ahiro.
What?
You black?
I look black?
You sound just like my mama.
For a split second there, when Ahiro came around the table with his arms outstretched, Obi thought he was going to follow through on the mother act and gather him up in his arms, but he leaned over him, his sleeves falling in Obi's face, and opened the window.
Breathe deep, really deep, and I'll have you weeping in no time. Breathe deep. Too bad the air's so bad in this town. But at least there's the music.
The raga reggae bumpity bing zing was pouring out all over Fred Holt from the open windows up over the Regal, where elderly women freed up from girdles and strict church upbringing bumped, glided, and rolled to the variation of Chet Telly that the four musicians on drum, oud, finger cymbals, chekara, and the pan fashioned.
Stomach flutters, ladies. Pant, pant, pant.
The dance teacher explained, straight-faced. Heel glide, pose, softened knee, stomach flutter, then dancing across the floor in veiled gathered pants and a coin bra, that orgasm exercised demons, and that these warm-up exercises were designed to strengthen the central enthusiastic muscles. The women tittered, hooted, blushed, or said, right on, with teeth gripping the lower lip in, depending on their hearing and their rearing and her delivery. Many much preferred the serious talks before the going across the floor part of the session, the part about temple dancing and sacred thighs and women worship and such like. They could deal with that. It was like the daydreaming of girlhood, the dreaming that drew them to the romance paperbacks, the soaps. But Miss Gwela Khufu, formerly Tina Mason, the seamstress's daughter, saw to it that they dealt with it all, temples, cabarets, bedrooms.
Don't cheat the body. Don't cheat the spirit, ladies. Do the whole movement.
She was saying, singling out the three black women and whispering,
remember?
And then weaving her way through the group to say to the Lebanese and Greek women,
remember?
And then confronting the one professional dancer in the group, a Pakistani,
remember?
Her veil sliding off the shoulders of the other women as if to say she was not ignoring them. Their roots in the sacred, their roots in the pelvic movements were different, that's all. She touched a hip here, a knee there, correcting, coaxing, not that she expected much from most of them, they were not ancient women after all, and the one little Chinese woman who was, well, there'd been no strong African presence in China, just a visit long ago in a golden boat with giraffes and gold and spices, a quick hello. When she was sure that no one was chafing for being ignored, she returned to the black women, the other ancient women, arched her brows sharply, triple-timed with the brass sills, her hands, fingers snaking over her head, and mouthed the word again. Remember? It was all right with everyone else. The woman was a mental case, but the classes were fun, and Gwela was a welcomed madness. Follow me, ladies, and breathe like you mean it. Leading the serpentine procession past the windows front, side, and back, kicking them open more widely with a flexed foot. Shake it like you mean it. Shake a wicked ass, ladies. Shake them moneymakers, ladies. Ladies was always delivered with a tincture of iodine. She'd started out with bitches, then witches, which was just too much. Sometimes, to puff them up on rainy days, she'd say goddesses or queens. That always sent the drummer right off. The women had finally sat Miss Gwela down and exercised their democratic rights. There were 8 votes for ladies and 6 for goddesses. 5 held out for sisters and were lobbying all the time. The pan man in dreadlocks and knitted cap aimed his mallets straight for the academy windows, his contribution to the new community germinating there. He'd been known to use the word postule when referring to the way the teachers there were steady realigning cultural and political loyalties, breeding new people. But the ladies, some of them, blanched at the word and drifted away to chew on their carrot sticks and wait for the break to end. Then he started using seed, which disturbed some but excited others, he noticed. Nowadays, he said enzyme, and grew to like it. It was scientific sounding. Slightly mysterious was finally exactly the term he'd been after to explain the work of the academy in this moment in time in human history. Pan Man squinted, trying to make out the shapes, movements, faces even of the forms in the window across the street. It was the best place he'd found in all the 7 years he'd spent in the States trying to educate people about the meaning of the pan, the wisdom of the pan. He bent low over his oil drum and played like a man possessed. The music drifted out over the trees toward the infirmary, Macam now blending with the bebop of Minnie Ransom's tapes. Minnie's hand was before her face, miming, talk, talk, graceful arcs from the wrist as though she were spinning silk straight from her mouth. The music pressing against the shawl draped round Velma, pressing through it against her skin, and Velma trying to break free of her skin to flow with it, trying to lift, to sing with it. And she did lift and was up under a sloping roof, eavesdropping on herself and Jamal in the orgone box under a pyramid and not believing a word of it, not going for one bullshit line of it, but listening to the instructions that would ease the knots. Submit. Don't be so damned stubborn, Velma, groaning under the needle in her mind, and not resisting it, only him. She was not a fool. A jibe nigger in a loincloth and a swami turban was a jibe nigger, whatever the case. Up in her perch, so like the talking room of childhood, peering through the floorboards and eavesdropping on the people below. Up in the air under the roof later, watching herself and James locked in a struggle that depleted and strangely renewed at the same time. And she leaned down to lift the needle, to yank the arm away, to pull apart the machinery in favor of her own voice. She would sing. Minnie would spin, and she would sing, and it would be silk. But when she opened her mouth, out came fire, and she was a dragon hovering over the room, flicking her golden smoking tail against the attic walls, the outstretched wings scaly and iridescent, the crimson eyes, the open jaws of blue smoke and orange flame, clawing at the planks of the floor, plunging through loose fill and plaster and wood and air and carpet and wood and loose fill and cement and clay and dirt and down, down into a drum. She had gone to the marshes once. It hadn't been a decision or even a thought. In retrospect, hugging herself inside the shawl, it hadn't even been an act. One minute she was arguing with her prayer partner, Jamal, whose so-called solutions to the so-called problem always lay in somebody else's culture, Tai Chi, TM, Reikian therapy, yoga. She argued that the truth was in one's own people, and the key was to be centered in the best of one's own traditions. She could have gone on all night, but then she felt it again, surrounded, flashes of pictures, scatterings of sounds, as though she had the stereo headset on ears and eyes and was thoroughly into the whatever it was. The next minute, she was at the marshes. There'd been a man there, at first, in gum boots with a basket, she assumed, of frogs. He'd touched his cap and moved off as though he'd known she wouldn't get her mouth working in time. And there'd been a dog with a nasty gash on the back of its neck. That had stopped her, fixed her on the spot. That was the moment she formed the words, "I've come to the marshes. I've just seen a man in gumboots. I'm looking at a wounded dog who is looking back at me." As if it had waited for her to catch up, to find the place in the script, the dog paused and then dropped down of a sudden and wallowed in the mud close to the shallows, and she'd been humbled watching it. A nondescript dog, wounded, come to the place to heal itself in the earth. There was a fallen tree by the patch of swamp punk. It seemed to be there for sitting. She sat. She knew she was waiting because she was no longer watching. She was aware of the dog's being there nearby, its paws in the air, its torso twisting. But she wasn't watching. She was waiting. She wasn't sure for what. For her clothes to feel like moss, for a tuning of strings, for a wind in the reeds, for her breathing to sink with the pulse of sap around her, for the trunk to sink, splinter, rot, and become humus for new growth? Since confrontation was her style, she formed the words to establish some order. I am waiting to confront it. She waited. And it was no different from the waiting most people she knew did. Waiting for a word from within, from above, from world events, from a shift in the power configurations of the globe. Waiting for a new pattern to assemble and reveal itself, or a new word to be uttered from the rally podium. From a pamphlet picked up at the neighborhood bookstore. A breakthrough. A sign. Waiting. Ready. She waited as though for battle, or for a lover, or for some steamy creature to arise, dripping and unbelievable from the marshes. She waited for panic. Panic. Pain. Pan-Africanism. All of us. Every god. Pan. All nature. Pan. Everywhere. She was grinning. As she always grinned when she was able to dig below the barriers organized religion erected in its push toward a bogus civilization. I'd welcome panic, she said aloud, certain of it. That said, that done and nothing forthcoming, she was waiting no longer. She was drifting, her gaze skimming the grasses, sliding to the far side of the marshes, its borders outlined by the salt froth on the inside, the crusty short grass and salt-stiff calamus on the outside. Traveling past was a cluster of gnats dancing in the air, lit at intervals by fireflies. Then up toward the hills on the far side of the spindly woods she used to play in as a child. The upcoast was showing her its bones in a straight selvage of blue-black rock. The river, not visible at all from where she sat, sunk deep between the far woods and the dark rock hills, having long ago carved out its path, then turned away its waters toward the savannah, its preference, the merging of the waters. But it let slip a minor current that would not make the turn, that went underground through the salt beds, then surfaced, miles later, in front of her, a marsh. It was the perfect place for it to happen, whatever there was to happen. On the site of metamorphosis, river, rain, underground spring, marsh, she felt ready, not tired and fed up, not beaten down and resigned, but ready. But maybe it didn't happen like that. Still, if it was going to happen, this was the place, the first place she had run to as a child fleeing the house. Things were active around her. What she'd thought was lichen coating the tree trunk with mottled green and white, or what she thought were fungus ledges that grew straight out from the bark in beige shelves, were colonies of bugs moving very fast. And for a moment, she thought she felt the headphone clamped on, sounds surround her and a pulling down. It occurred to her that if they slowed down, they would look at a glance like what they were. Bugs. And if they speeded up, they'd be not visible bugs looking like lichen, but the idea of bugs resonating in her brain. Time. Time not speeding up, but opening up to take her inside. It seemed quite reasonable and friendly and usable, sitting there with things occurring to her rather than tracking her, haunting her, terrorizing her, catching her up, taking her over till she thought she was losing her mind, which was nothing compared to the thought that she might become a permanent cripple of no serviceable use to anyone anymore. So, to maintain order, she tried forming some other words gleaned from this visit, this calm, something she could tell herself when the crowding began, when the pictures began, when the mud mothers called out to her. Something she could remember to be wide open with so she wouldn't have to invest all of herself staying intensely occupied, eyes, ears, mind riveted on the task at hand, the work ahead, lest she be taken over. She found no words, nor a brief passage of music. Nothing stayed fixed and available for later. Tightening the shawl about her, vaguely listening to the music, feeling the healer's hands on her arms, she remembered that that marsh visit had failed to inform her days and her nights. It had failed to inform her mind the minute she got up from the tree. Whatever had occurred stayed behind. And home again, the terrors crouched behind chairs and bookcases. Velma shuddered and sank deeply into the music. The dum teta teta tac tat dear tick, piercing the wall between the dance studio and the one skinny rooming house left on the hill, jammed between the Regal and the Patterson Professional Building. Campbell roused himself from the chair, his arms asleep, his nose clogged, prickles in his legs, needles in his feet, hot and dusty under the rag rug he'd thrown over himself for a quick nap, shorts soupy and shirt salt stiff after a jog through the heights, pumping up neuroadrenaline, the only antidepressant he trusted now. He stretched and jumped free of the chair as if taking off a lead coat. Dum da da dum teta teta dear. He checked his watch, springing into the shower. 3 hours at the cafe, the writer's workshop at the academy, the late class with the widow woman, Haywood. He tried a scissor kick in the shower, and the rubber mat did not fail him. Give me an S. Spiral breath. Rubbing himself briskly with the towel. Give me an O. Rolling in dough. Climbing into his pants. Give me a good PH for health.
Sis, boom, mama.
Give me an... He took the banister down to the first landing.
Mr. Campbell.
His landlady was in her doorway, tut-tutting and stuffing clumps of gray up under a bright white wig advertised, no doubt, as platinum. He smiled and buttoned his shirt. He recognized a hopeful from Central Casting when he saw one.
About the rent?
The classic script. He could have written it himself, except he abhorred the cliché. Not only do I have the rent, he said, pulling his pockets inside out and flinging gold coins, drachmas, pesos, yen all over the hallway, money she chose to ignore in favor of the usual check, backed by equally imaginary currency, but I'm going to mention you in my very next article. A feature piece on the Spring Festival, covering it exclusive for the dailies and the weekly. None of them have sense enough to send out one of their own reporters. It's the big time, Mrs. Terry. The landlady backed into her doorway, tut-tutting while the crazy man, Gene Kellyed, down the front steps, racing behind the paperboy, doing throaty sounds like the sports car she'd just bought for her nephew. She did not close her door, though. She waited till he was well on his way before she tiptoed out and looked up the stairwell. She wanted another peek into that telescope he had up there. Though what could possibly be going on over at the academy that could be so interesting, she hadn't a clue. The bike waffled for a minute till Lil James, called Jabari now, stood up on the pedals, found a graded curb, and could get away from the jerk growling at him. Campbell stood, arms akimbo, watching the kid strain up the hill, the cords standing out in his neck, shoulders, his arms bulging. He tipped his hat he wasn't wearing to acknowledge effort like that. It looked as though any minute the boy's jeans would tear, his shirt rip, his clothes pop off and fly up like the kites the kids were writing notes to God on and releasing on the day before festival. 8. Meadows would have preferred a walk in the woods. Stumbling about aimlessly amidst trees and squirrels on the hunt for the essential selves of the patient and the healer would not have been nearly so alarming as fumbling along the pavement, crossing streets for no reason, attracting attention to his foreignness, attracting danger. To walk in the woods, one needed a gun, just a prop to guise the meandering. In these unknown streets, who knew what was needed? All he had was the blue notebook from the orientation packet, and it wouldn't stay put. He was sure he had worn his pocket lining thin, sliding his fist in and out to readjust his grip. It occurred to him to roll the thing and jam it into his belt. He even considered carrying it in his mouth like a bone. Passing an old lard can rolling around on the curb, he toyed with the idea of pitching his notebook in it and catching a plane back home. But he hadn't taken such careful notes, and he felt drawn, was the word, to the place. Supper. Supper. He mouthed it as the old man with the gold tooth at the bus stop might. He pictured himself safely tucked under a hefty table leaf, a threadbare but clean tablecloth covering his lap, chipped bowls overladen with food hemming him in, and friendly boarders passing platters, easy with each other, easy with him. He found himself daydreaming on a family he'd never had, a mother who ran a boarding house and who treated the roomers as kin, a father who told the women hands off and taught the boy how to handle a hammer, a gun, a carving knife at Thanksgiving time. So he walked the streets at loose ends, making up things to keep himself company. Supper. It sounded so homey, frugal, but homey. Triflin'. Man, you so triflin'. He said it the way he imagined the woman from the cafe might, not contemptuous, but affectionately surly. He smiled and turned a corner without a clue as to what to do with himself now. It had been years since he'd had more than 2 unscheduled hours on his hands. His dawns to dusks to dawns for so long crammed full with the hospital, the guild, pacemaker executives and their barbiturized wives and traumatized offspring, meetings, seminars, insurance agents, pharmaceutical salesmen, burglar alarm specialists, head nurses vying with him for jurisdiction over patients, his partners dumping troublesome cases on his desk and keeping the Medicaid and Medicare gold mines for themselves. He'd been walking the streets for what seemed like hours, sweaty and hungry one minute, exhilarated and greedy to see more the next. Some blocks back, he'd passed a park where kids, youths, adult men and women, elders, all in bright T-shirts with 7 Arts stenciled across the back, had been setting up as if for a fair. Tables, tents, awnings, rides, fortune tellers, candy booths, gymnasts with mats, nets, trampolines, oil drums from the islands, congos from who knew where, flat trucks, platforms, push carts and stalls of leather crafts, carved cooking spoons, jewelry, and the like. He had meant to stop and pick up their literature, but it would have meant crossing a boulevard with no traffic lights or pedestrian markings. Now he couldn't remember how to double back. Where he walked was quiet and vacant. Lots, closed stores with fly-speckled windows, a bank where a man looking like that Doc Surge should be standing, a watch chain across his vest. But there was no one and nothing much to look at. He felt in Claiborne like a late arrival to one of those obligatory cocktail parties, hanging by the bookcase or leaning against the baby grand trying to catch the party's beat. Always exhausting his repertoire after 2 encounters, he finally became the 3-toed sloth he's always known himself to be, counting the blacks and whites of the party and then of the keyboard, tracing the pattern in the rug with 1 spit-shined loafer, oblivious that the other was planted mercilessly on his hostess's crepe de chine slipper. "Putty-colored 3-toed sloth," he said aloud in the empty street, and having run out of sidewalk, crossed over to turn still another corner. "Putty-colored 3-toed sloth." His stepfather's idea of a nickname was usually his signal to go home to finger another soggy sandwich, drain his cup or glass if he had one, and leave.